Welcome to The Rescue Radio, the show that brings you closer to the outdoors. I'm Anya Viktorovich, and I'm very happy that you're joining us today. Hi friends, what do you do when you get lost in the total whiteout on a mountain? Today, my guests are two rescuees from June 6th mission on Mount Hood, Brennan Crowder and Jacob Bowling, and a rescuer who was helping them get down the mountain, Steve Rollins.
So my name is Jacob Bowling. I'm a senior at the University of Portland, majoring in economics, minoring in sustainability. And I've been mountain climbing, I think, like the first mountain I ever climbed, which is kind of a big mountain for really my first actual mountain climb, I suppose, was Mount Shasta, my freshman year of high school. We didn't summit, but then I attempted it again. Also didn't summit. My friend broke his leg. But then I was kind of hooked, and mountain climbing has always really interested me since then. I read Into Thin Air, and I've also just been into the outdoors my whole life. And my dad is an outdoorsman and, you know, took us on, we used to call them death marches as children. Like I remember being 3 years old and hiking like 15 miles or something like that. And I'm also an Eagle Scout. I was in Boy Scouts, and now I'm a trip leader for the University of Portland, and I've led a few trips. And I also climbed Mount St. Helens a few weeks ago, and then I attempted Mount Hood a few weeks before this fateful summit, but then, you know, rescue, and it was unsuccessful due to rain and bad weather. And yeah, that's all about me.
I'm Brennan Crowder. I'm a mechanical engineering student going into my senior year at University of Portland. I kind of caught the climbing bug when I was probably 10 or 12, somewhere in there. I climbed a Camp Muir with my dad and my younger brother. My dad was a big climber and outdoorsman his whole life. And, the one peak on the West Coast that he never got to was Mount Hood. So that really drew me into, summiting Hood with Jacob this past week. And yeah, I was never an Eagle Scout. I never did Boy Scouts because the one meeting I went to was all knots and I thought it was boring. But thankfully, my parents were both very adamant that I need to have outdoor skills. And so I did a lot of skiing, snowboarding, hiking, camping. I mean, you name it, I've done it. Basically, the entire Boy Scouts thing without any of the patches.
I'm Steve Rollins. I'm a rescue leader with Portland Mountain Rescue. And, on the day that these fellows got lost up Mountain Hood, I was able to make phone contact with them and help them down.
Thank you. All right, so let's get to it. Why don't you guys tell us about your day?
Sure. So really, this isn't something that we like. I mean, we obviously plan for it. So, you know, Mountain Expedition, it's not like we just woke up randomly at 11 p.m. and said, all right, you want to go climb Mountain Hood? You know, you have to plan for it a little bit, obviously. But it's not something like for weeks and weeks we had been planning on like the specific day. I like had attempted it earlier on in the season, a few weeks earlier. And so I just kind of was monitoring the weather and it had kind of gotten worse. And Brennan actually changed the oil in my car the weekend prior. And I was like, hey, you want to climb Mount Hood next weekend? And he was like, sure.
I don't know. On the one hand, retrospectively looking back, I feel like we didn't really prepare for it at all. And I think experienced climbers would be appalled at the lack of preparation we had for this. But going into it, like, we did do some preparation, right? Like, it's like Jacob said, we didn't just wake up at 11 and decide, I guess I'll tackle Hood tonight. I mean, we got all of our equipment ready. We both spent a lot of times on the forums reading about routes and hazards and stuff like that. I had a general bearing memorized to the parking lot, but I mean, that didn't really help. We didn't do a whole lot of physical preparation, but we're in pretty good shape. So, you know,
I think the night before we just finally got everything together, just the night before we got our gear from Next Adventure, downtown Portland, great place. And we got mountaineering boots from there, beacons. And then because I'm a trip leader at the University of Portland, we kind of just went and raided the University of Portland gear locker. And we grabbed ice axes from there, crampons. I had a beacon and probe I grabbed from there as well. And then we were like, all right, good night. It's like 8 o'clock on a Saturday night. You know, our friends were, you know, obviously both in college, or at least my housemates, you know, had to go sleep in my girlfriend's house because my house would be too loud to try to sleep on a weekend night. So we went in for the long nap of like 2.5 hours, you know, and I think, what time did we set our alarms for?
I want to say it was like 11:30.
So that's how our day started.
How was the weather when you got to the base?
I was actually shocked. I remember, so like the first 3 weeks earlier, which, you know, given the passing of time, you would imagine would be warmer or colder, that is, and warmer now. And earlier it was pouring rain and obviously not freezing temperatures. When I was climbing up, it was like slushy the whole way. And it was just a downpour. And we get to the parking lot at whatever time it was, 1 a.m. And I was just shocked to walk outside and like the parking lot was like an ice skating rink. It was like completely frozen, like ice everywhere. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah, I almost hated getting out of the car.
It was way colder than I was expecting, but it was pretty clear. I don't think we could see the sky yet.
So why don't you talk about the, as it got more technical, so because you've got the slog up Palmer and whatnot. And I'm sure, you know, you're getting closer to, you know, Crater Rock, what you observed on your way up. And also the excitement that I assume was building, you know, as you, you know, like, hey, we're going to make this. We're going to make the summit today.
Yeah, I remember Jacob's leading. And I remember kind of going around the foot of Crater Rock and kind of starting to see Devil's Kitchen kind of in there. And I remember there were some people behind us. Actually, there were quite a lot of people behind us that ended up turning back right as we were kind of at the kind of skirting the base of Crater Rock. And I remember seeing that and thinking, like, just trying to keep in mind if we should summit or not, because we can always come back. And I remember I brought it up a couple times to you, like, you know, how you feeling, right? Because what I was pretty sure was going to happen was that we were going to get to like Hog's Back. And Jacob's going to cramp, and then I'm going to have to carry him down the mountain.
Oh, come on.
And so that's why I kept asking you, like, you know, how you feeling? And, you know, I was feeling pretty good. It was probably probably the most strenuous physical activity I'd done in all of quarantine. But I was feeling good, you know, ready for it. And, yeah, I just remember going up there and realizing that we were tail end Charlie on the way up. The other thing I remember that sticks out in my mind a lot is trying to, like, making mental notes of what the rock formations look like. But I spent a lot of time doing that on the way up, just kind of orienting myself with multiple different geographic features. Because it's, you know, I remember looking back down the slope on the ascent and realizing, like, you know, you could kind of see where the trail was, but unless you were right on those tracks, it was kind of difficult to see. I mean, you could, if you knew what you're looking for, you kind of see it. I was afraid that we were on the way down, if we were the last people, that it was going to get difficult to follow a trail down. I remember stopping there and Hog's Back, taking a long, hard look at ourselves and going, like, are we really fit to go to the summit? Because that to me was kind of the turning point. You know, if we're going to do it or not, this is the time to decide. And I was feeling tired, but pretty good. And I think you seem to be in the same boat because, you know, ironically, I had read Into Thin Air right before this. I think I'd finished it like the Friday before. And I remember one of the lines that really stuck out to me was basically, anybody can get to the top of a mountain, but getting down is the harder part because you spend so much energy getting up, like making sure you have the energy reserves to get back down. And I didn't want that to happen to us.
So the verdict was to go up?
Yeah, I asked Jacob, I said, you know, what are you thinking? And he's like, I want to get to the top. And I said, you know, me too. And how are you feeling? And the consensus that it was that we were both feeling good. And
how was the climb up?
In terms of weather, crystal clear. And yeah. It was really beautiful, actually, watching the sunrise.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think this is not, I think it's something that a lot of mountaineers feel, and it's something that probably isn't great. But like, when you get to like a certain point where you can kind of feel like the summit is up there somewhere, or it starts to get more technical. And like, I just like kind of in some ways disregard if I'm like too tired, like I feel good enough. Like I, you know, barring a weather storm that was to come in on the way up, I want to keep going.
Would you say that the summit was seductive at all at that point, that you were kind of getting sucked in and focused on it?
you know, the final like vertical stretch where it actually gets, you know, a lot more technical. I was like, I think we can do this. When we like traversed from Hogsback to Old Chute, at the base of Old Chute, after the hot rocks, we got to the top and we're like, all right, should we do this?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I would definitely say the summit was pretty compelling, especially just right there at the base. You can see it. You can see everybody coming up and going down. But I remember this in the back of my, there's this little voice in the back of my mind of my mom telling me, she said, you can always come back and try it again. It doesn't have to be the first time. You know, at the time I was like, yeah, you know, I know, mom, you're just trying to keep me safe. You know, that really sat with me, especially there in that last check-in before we made that final summit assault. The weather and everything still looked good, but I was very aware that we were the last people.
So you talked about seeing other people. Did that contribute to some of your decision-making? Did seeing other people contribute to your comfort?
Yeah, I think absolutely. These people we were with or we saw, they definitely seemed to be a little bit more legit mountain climbers. It's hard to say, but at least they seemed like they had some better gear than we did. There were some people who were skinning up, or at least had left their skis, who had skinned up to that point at Hogsback. But I think definitely there was a feeling of safety seeing other mountain climbers there. Like obviously Mount Hood on like a really beautiful day is like a zoo. There's a ton of people, but on this day, it just was a little bit empty, but when we finally got to this final point, it was like, okay, this isn't really a big deal because there's all these people here. We have the gear. They have the gear. We see the summit. We have great visibility. We knew our turnaround time. We set it, I think 9:30 was our turnaround time.
Yeah.
And we were making great time. I think it was like before 7 something,
yeah,
6 something when we got to the Hogsback. So that definitely made us feel like, all right, we should just summit.
There was definitely, I think, a little bit of a lemming effect.
So take us to the summit. So you're on the summit. How'd that feel? And then like what happened from there?
We started a little traverse to go. We went up like the Mazama chute or the 2 o'clock chute of Old Chute. So we had a little traverse to go, but it wasn't like the knife edge traverse. It looked like a pretty mellow traverse to the summit. And I was like, we did it. It's right there.
How much time did you spend on the summit?
Honestly, probably less than 10 minutes.
Okay.
I mean, really, it was a pretty quick turnaround. Yeah. We got up there and took some pictures and visibility was still great. I mean, it looked like it had grayed slightly, but at much, much higher altitude than we were actually at. Yeah. And I remember taking that last selfie together and kind of looking over the north side and being like, that looks like a lot of snow that's rolling in. From then on, visibility, like, I mean, it really, Jacob and I talked about this. It kind of just seemed like a whiteout just rolled across the top. And we kind of ran from the summit to that sort of false summit at the top of the 2 o'clock chute, which is probably not what you're supposed to do with crampons. But I mean, we really boogied over from the summit to that descent. And then from then on, I remember going over Jacob went over first. And I remember standing there kind of looking at him and facing down the south side, trying to get a really good look, like one final look at what the terrain looked like, because we had ascended. Originally, we were going to climb the Old Chute. And then when we got to Hogsback, the people that had gone up were like, hey, don't bother with Old Chute. You should go 2 o'clock. It's much better. That's what everyone else is doing. And we're like, okay, cool. So we did that. But that put us further skiers left than we had really prepared for. And so I remember thinking on the way down, it's like, I don't want to get disoriented. I want to know where we're coming down so that we can hit the hot rocks down there and make our way back. And then I started to descend, and very quickly, like basically as soon as I was sort of on top of you, Jacob was wearing a red helmet and it got really hard to see his red helmet. And you were wearing like kind of a dark blue, black jacket, and that became difficult to see too.
So it got worse as you were down climbing?
Yeah, it got a lot worse. I mean, it was rolling in pretty steady since we sort of ran off the summit, but it really started to get bad once we were descending the 2 o'clock chute, and very rapidly. I mean, conditions devolve really rapidly. And Jacob and I have both been in whiteouts before, skiing, mountaineering and stuff, but this one was by far the worst I had ever been in. And of course, the stakes were the highest, because that's usually how that works.
When did you decide to call for help?
That was further down that ice wall. We were, I don't know, probably 100, 200 vertical feet above the hot rocks. not, I mean, we were roughly where we thought we were, but we couldn't see. The problem was that visibility was terrible. We could see some kind of dark outlines to skiers right and also skiers left. And we knew that there were sort of cliffs in some areas that we didn't want to get near. And we also knew that the Birkschund was sort of over to skiers left somewhere, but we didn't really know how close we were to that. And so we were trying, we descended straight down for a while and then descended pretty hard left after that. And based on the coordinates that 911 was able to call, we were pretty close to where we thought we were. That was a gamble that we didn't really want to take, getting to those hot rocks where we thought we were, because if we were wrong, it would be, it would have been a much nastier story.
It got really intense for me when we were like down climbing, and like there's a portion where you pretty much have to be facing the wall with your ice axe and like kicking in with your crampons and hitting your ice axe and kicking in with the crampons all the way down. And it was so hard to see, and it was blowing so hard, and like just ice chips were hitting our face. And like, that's when like really it started to get more serious for me in my head, is like, it was really steep. Like it was definitely scary, but we had some adrenaline going and I couldn't see anything, but I was just like really making sure my ice axe got in and really kicking in my crampons, just doing that over and over as fast as we could.
I remember being on the way down and just being like, I should have known better. These are like the exact conditions that happened in Into Thin Air on Everest in 96. I'm like, it's like almost the same thing. And I remember being honestly pretty disappointed in myself that I let myself fall into the same trap that those guys did, albeit on a much smaller scale. You know, that weather kind of rolled in. You know, we didn't disobey our turnaround time by any means, but it kind of just makes you think, like, should I have listened to my gut earlier on? I mean, I don't know. I think based off everything that we knew and felt on the way up, we still felt like we were making the right decision.
We got to a certain point where we're like, okay, we're off like the really steep stuff. We're still like really facing the ice wall, the chute, the whole time with our ice axe. But we just did not know where we were. We knew we like had descended as hard and as fast as we could for a certain amount of time, which I'm not even sure how much it was. But we were like, okay, now what? You know, we didn't know, do we go more left? Do we go more right? And okay, what do we do now? There is a crevasse somewhere underneath the pearly gates. Are we too far, you know, skiers left? Are we, you know, if we go too far right, we're going to miss, you know, the hot rocks, go way off on the chute. I know there's a cliff down there somewhere. It's fumaroles. And so that's when we like really stopped and just kind of started talking, trying to figure out what to do. And where we eventually called 911 from, because we were like, wow, this is actually getting serious.
Yeah. Originally you pulled out the SpotX or the GPS or whatever. And we kind of looked at each other and we're like, you know, we're not really going to get out of this completely on our own. We're going to need some help. And we pressed the SOS button on the GPS thing and absolutely nothing happened. Like not even like a confirmation message that we pressed the button. I guess we'll try our phones, and your phone didn't have service, but mine did. Patched us through to 911. And I don't remember which dispatcher location it sent us to. They basically asked what was our emergency, and I was like, well, we're somewhere on Mount Hood and it's a complete whiteout and we can't see where we are. We'd like some help getting down. And she was like, okay. She's like, well, it looks like your location is roughly this, but stay on the line for a little bit so I can get a more accurate reading. Transfer you to whoever. We're gonna hang up, but they'll call you back. And I was like, well, how long should we wait, right? Because I don't know how long my cell service mm-hmm. is going to, you know, remain. And so I was afraid that this was just kind of a anomaly in the cell service. And it turns out it wasn't. But I don't know, maybe 5 minutes later, we got a call back from the sheriff, I think. And I don't remember where he was from either. Who then eventually said that he was going to patch us through to Portland Mountain Rescue. And then that finally happened. And I believe we were finally patched through to Eric. I forget his last name. Brahms. Yeah, Eric Brahms. Mm-hmm. And he was the one that basically said, you know, you're going to want to descend a little bit and then go skiers right. But before that happened, 911 was basically just like, sit tight. And it was probably, I don't know, 10 minutes maybe, but before we got called back. And I remember thinking, they said, don't move. But we were getting really cold. At least I was getting really cold. The wind was blowing really bad. The temperature was really cold. And, you know, we were dressed for it, obviously, but it was, the wind really made it a lot harder.
Mm-hmm. What kind of clothing did you have with you?
I was wearing sweatpants and then hiking pants and then, like, you know, snow pants, basically, long underwear, kind of top, a t-shirt and then a long underwear sort of top, and then a down jacket and then a rain jacket. And then we were wearing beanies and helmets. I was wearing my glasses. You know, we had snow gloves. Mm-hmm. We had thick wool socks and boots.
Winter climbing clothing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we had definitely prepared for the temperatures we were going to be in, but but on the way down when that storm rolled in, it was, I mean, it dropped the temperature by a lot. It got really cold
and you're not
really
moving,
fast.
You're just sitting.
Right. We got to sit there and the wind is blowing and it's way colder than it was. And I remember right before the sheriff called us back, I was telling Jacob, like, I need to move or else I'm going to get too cold. Like we had been shadow boxing and stuff and just like, you know, slapping our hands together and stuff, trying to stay warm. But I remember telling him, like, I'm just going to walk 10 feet skiers right and make sure I don't lose visual contact of you, but just so I can kind of pace back and forth and see where you are. And right before I started to do that, we got a call back. And that's when Eric was on the phone and sort of gave us a general direction on where to get to the Hot Rocks. Because at that point, I was pretty certain that if we could get to the Hot Rocks, we could get the rest of the way down.
So for people that haven't been in a whiteout, I don't think that they understand how disorienting it can be yet.
Oh, yeah.
I sometimes characterize it like having a pillowcase tied over your head. Can you describe that a little bit about how difficult it was to navigate?
I've definitely been in, I'm a big skier, I've been skiing since I was 3 years old, and I've been in whiteouts before where it's like just super disorienting, you can't see anything, and it can sometimes feel nauseating. And this was just an intense whiteout where like I almost felt like vomiting multiple times just because you couldn't tell the slope of the snow at all. And you couldn't tell the difference between the snow, like the actual surface we were walking on in the sky in any direction, unless we happened to see a rock or we happened to see like anything that was really close in proximity. Later started to actually get moving some more and we're walking. It just is so disorienting because you don't know if like your next step is going to be off a cliff because you cannot see at all. And so I kept just being like, whoa, 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 what is that? I can't see. It just is hard to see anything.
I remember there was a couple times that both of us kind of tripped, not full on tripped, but like kind of started to stumble. The slope had actually changed. We had gone to a very slight uphill and then another downhill. Couldn't see it. When we called 911, visibility was so bad. Jacob and I were within arm's reach of each other and I couldn't see his facial expression. It is like having a pillowcase or something tied over your head. It's still bright to some extent. It's very disorienting, you know, especially when you see the larger snowflakes start to move. That almost changes, like if you sat in an office chair and somebody spun you around really, really, really fast in an all white room.
Do you know how far you were from Hot Rocks?
I want to say, I think we were pretty close. I think we were probably 100 or 200 feet skiers left of Hot Rocks and maybe 100, 200 feet, 200 vertical feet above it. Mm-hmm. So we were pretty close. We were definitely within sight of it once we started moving that direction. But honestly, I thought it was the other direction until Eric had got on the phone with us and told us that it was actually the other direction. And then we were able to see more, get a better picture.
Can you describe how he explained to you which way to go? Did you have a compass with you or?
Yeah, I had a compass. We also had that GPS that Jacob had. That wasn't working at the time. It said our altitude was like 2,000 feet and we were probably at like 10,800 or something. I mean, we were a lot higher than
2,000. A little off.
Yeah, quite a bit off. I had an old school, like really cheap compass, but he basically said, I want you to go skiers right. And then, you know, probably about 100 feet and then slowly start to descend. You should see it. Look for like a dark shape in the snow. That'll be the rock outcropping that you want to shoot for. And as we made our way that direction, we were able to see it. As soon as I saw that, it was a huge elation for me because it was, okay, we're going to get through this. You know, it was multiple steps up, like from being like the complete bottom despair of having to call 911 and then finally being patched through to somebody. That was a huge relief. And then also getting to where we kind of needed to be was also another step even above that.
So you made it to Hot Rocks. What happens next?
Yeah, so that was really a turning point, at least in my head, in that like I really didn't try to ever let myself think I'm going to die or I might die even. But like it's hard to not let that kind of creep in at times. Like I really, you know, I commend both myself and Brennan for not like getting to the point of panic or hysteria in any way. But like it could have got there because the situation we were in, the way it felt was like we could die. You know, like this is really scary. And like when we finally got to Hot Rocks and we took a deep breath and we have never been more happy to see some dirt. Okay. It's where like the rocks on Mount Hood, the volcanic activity melts some of that snow. And we were like walking on dirt and we were like just talking with each other like, oh my God. Like I felt like I was like a little verklempt at the top of Mount Hood when we first summited. And this is another time I felt a little verklempt. I was like, okay, I think we're going to make it. We're not going to die here. And it was still difficult, obviously, getting down from that point, but we were moving. We weren't just going to freeze to death sitting there. And that was a good thing.
Yeah, that was a huge confidence boost for me too. Knowing that we had gotten in touch with somebody knew where we were and how to get us down from there, and also being somewhere where we recognized where we were, those were huge. I mean, that was a huge confidence boost to us as a team.
And how did they keep in touch with you? Did they keep calling you back or...
A little bit of both. We would, I think I was the primary contact, but we sometimes Steve would say, go this heading and don't descend below this altitude and call me back if you get to there or 5 to 10 minutes elapses, or sometimes it'd be the other way around. We would call him or he would call us, something like that. The first time we got in touch with Steve was on Hogsback, because we got to Hogsback, but the route that we took from the Hot Rocks to Hogsback looked totally right. We looked a lot closer to that kind of like crevasse or hole or whatever that is down at the base of Crater Rock. And it seemed a little weird, but the snow seemed all right. And we got up to Hogsback and we realized that we were really close to Crater Rock. And I think we were debating among each other, you know, are we where we're supposed to be? Should we descend? Should we kind of hang high and go, you know, try to stay near Crater Rock? And I think that's right when Steve called us.
So Steve, tell us your side.
Eric had made initial contact with them. And after talking with them and finding that they were going to need some assistance, he called me and asked if I could call them back and try to talk them down and also get PMR, you know, started and route to the mountain in case we had to come up and get them. So I agreed to do that, putting the call out to PMR to get rescuers responding to the mountain, and also to contact these guys with the idea that I might be able to leverage their GPS and their compass and talk them down through the whiteout.
Yeah. So once we got from Hot Rocks to the Hogsback, which I remember thinking to myself, we got to the Hot Rocks, I was feeling like a breath of relief. Okay, we can find our way down. But then this is what began the long, long way down of me just being so confused. I mean, I just, because like every once we get close to something, we'd be like, oh, this must be this. Oh no, that must be that. And it just was so disorienting, confusing, still in a whiteout, still feeling nauseous sometimes. I just remember thinking so many times, like, this doesn't make sense. Is this what we were at? How is this here? Why is that there? It just doesn't look the same because we couldn't see.
Yeah, it seemed like, I don't think this is probably the actual case, but it seemed like Hogsback had blown like 200 feet like west of where it was. I mean, it just seemed like it was in the total wrong spot, and it like nothing made sense. Like through sort like very mild breaks in the whiteout, we could see other features and just nothing. It almost seemed like an over constrained situation. There were too many things telling me two different things.
That's when I first made contact with you. I figured there was some level of anxiety or you wouldn't have called 911. So one of my goals was just to give you guys some confidence and calming that, hey, you know, I know where you're at. You gave me a good description. We're going to get you down. Either we'll come up and get you or we can walk you down, but things are going to be okay. And you did give me really good description, the Hogsback and looking at Crater Rock. So I was pretty darn confident you were there. And once you gave me your GPS coordinates, after converting coordinate systems and doing a little bit of mathematical calculations and whatnot, converting your meters to feet and whatnot, we figured out where you were. And you were like within 50 feet of where I thought you were, according to the coordinates. So, you know, that was good. My biggest concern was knowing what it's like in a whiteout. Like you said, you can walk right off a crevasse. You could walk into Fumeral, into Devil's Kitchen, off a cliff, all sorts of things. So we had to be very careful. And I really encourage you guys, I'm going to give you some general directions, but you need to use your best judgment. And you can always call me right back. And we kind of get your coordinates, and I would give you a bearing and a distance and hazards to look out for, and have you call me back in, you know, 10 minutes, or, you know, sometimes even 5 minutes. And we just kind of worked your way down like that, continuing to check and correct as you went down.
Basically, it also was comical at times. I would just have so much hope. I remember we'd like follow a bearing and be like, all right, Steve gave us confidence again. This is where we are. He knows where we are. He's converted my meters from my GPS, which he later, a few days ago, showed us how to convert to feet by just clicking a different button. But, you know, and he gave us confidence. Okay. He was like, yes, great. This is exactly where you're supposed to be. And we're like, yes. And like, he gave us a new bearing, and like this confusion, we just continued in the whiteout though, because like we'd follow his bearing on the compass, and Brendan's compass kept icing over and becoming frozen. So it was like really difficult to use. And he'd set the bearing and we'd go down, and then I would think like, oh, okay. I think I know where we are. We just got to go right here. And then this is okay. This is where we came around. And then it just was not at all the correct thing. And we'd have to call Steve back.
Yeah. It was one hell of a hodgepodge system we had going, because your GPS was able to give us lat long coordinates, but nothing else useful. I mean, the altitude was in meters and still pretty wrong. My phone was able to, for reference, I have an iPhone 11. So the GPS on that seemed like it was working great. The altimeter, Steve was saying, was within like 50 to 100 feet of where it thought we were. And I had an old school compass with a lanyard that I had tied around my wrist. And so basically what we would do is we called Steve. I'd kind of put us on a general point, use my phone compass to get us in a general direction for our bearing or our heading. And then I would confirm that with my old school compass. And then we would sort of descend that way to where we thought was about right. And then I would double check my phone, because what I was really scared of is with all that wind and that terrain that I was going to drop my phone, and then we were just going to be screwed. I mean, we had tried to, there's one point where my phone didn't have connection and Jacob called 911 and they threw him back and forth between different 911 stations and had no idea what we were talking about. And it was from then on, I was like, you know, I'm going to keep my phone in my pocket at all times and not let it go anywhere, because, you know, if I'm a couple degrees off with my old school compass, that's better than losing all contact.
You know, your comment about the compass phrasing is interesting too, because that is a pretty low cost, you know, entry level compass. And, you know, a cheap compass, a lot of times they will cut corners and liquid fill them with water instead of other fluids that don't freeze quite as easily. They're all more or less made to be used above freezing, but that's, with a better quality compass, you're not going to have quite as much trouble with that. Yeah. You know, I teasingly told these guys that compass was kind of a Cub Scout compass, not a mountaineer's
yeah,
compass.
Yeah, it definitely was.
I think one of the other challenges that we had converting lat long, which we could use, but it was easier with maps to convert from lat long over to a UTM coordinate system. We had the meters to feet conversion, and then your compass doesn't accommodate for true versus magnetic declination. And so I had to continue to give you magnetic bearings to go off of rather than true north bearings. So that's why I say there was a little bit of magic involved between each check-in to figure out exactly where you were and where you needed to go. But we did work that out.
Yeah.
Steve, what was the general plan of the rescue?
That's a great question. We actually have tried to talk people down the mountain before with similar kinds of equipment, and it has not gone as well as it did with you guys. You guys did, though you're readily admitting things that you could have done differently, you did a lot of things right too. And I was very impressed with your ability, especially with that compass, to follow in a complete whiteout, a bearing that I gave you, and follow it for a considerable distance and barely be off. But we've done this before where we've finally had to just tell somebody, all right, sorry, you do need to stay put. We're going to come to you. This isn't working out. And so, you know, that's something that I think is really special about PMR is we had a bunch of rescuers that drove all the way up to Timberline Lodge and were there ready to go enter the field to come get you if this wasn't working out, or you wandered and fell off a, you know, cliff or a crevasse or into a funeral, you know, lots of bad things could have happened. And I think that that speaks a lot to the commitment to our rescuers. You know, I think that those guys knew, hey, Steve's talking him down, you know, I might not be needed. But they were still willing to drive all the way up there with their own gas money, their own time away from their families to sit there. But anyway, we basically had a two-fold plan. One, have team ready to respond to you if anything went wrong. And then I was pretty confident, especially the way you guys were working, that we were going to get you down and our rescuers could stay warm in the lodge. So,
what were the things that you wish you took with you?
I wish we brought a better GPS. I mean, I think that goes without saying, but a GPS where we could set waypoints ahead of time on the way up, and also that had a little bit more capability than this one that we had. That one was, being able to use UTM coordinates and also having a magnetic compass built in and an altimeter, and being able to set and navigate to preset GPS points, whether I do them on the fly on the way up or do them ahead of time, that would have been great. I mean, I think if we had that, it would have been a whole lot of just going, damn, this snow kind of sucks. At least we have a way to get down. That would be a big thing for me. Also, maybe a compass with something other than a kerosene water mix or whatever that's in it, because right. Having to thaw that thing really sucked. You know, you're walking down, you're like, I think this is the general heading we're on, and I have a compass in my shirt and just kind of walking down like, oh, it's not quite thawed yet, give it some more time. And that kind of sucked.
I agree, obviously. Believe it or not, my GPS does actually have a way to preload waypoints onto it. Of course, did I think that was necessary? Why would I be prepared like that? Now, in the future, of course, even if I use this GPS, which does not have as much functionality, I definitely want to invest in a better GPS. This is, you know, I think I will in the future never go up on a mountain without being able to essentially blindfold myself and find a way to get down, even if it's a clear day. And I really like something that I think you told us, Steve, which is like, you really shouldn't be going up on like Mount Hood above the tree line on a day that it is forecasting to have clouds in the next like 24 hours, or like have like a snowstorm in any way, you know? And I certainly will be choosing the middle of like three sunny days to get up there, I think. So
let's talk about the things that went well.
The one thing I have to admit to myself a little bit, it was kind of big brain in the moment, was the snow started to get kind of slabby. But Jacob was below me at this point. We were kind of descending down the Hog's Back. And I remember seeing like these big pieces of snow. They weren't that big. I don't know. They were probably, there's these kind of like chunks that would break off when he would step down. And the way Jacob was walking, he would kind of kick those slabs down the slope a little bit. And I remember being like, you know, Jacob was like, I can't see anything. Neither of us could see anything at all. And we were really concerned with cliffs and stuff like that and sudden terrain changes that we couldn't see through the whiteout. And I remember like taking those slabs, we'd step and I'd pick them up and we'd kind of toss them down the mountain. And it would only get us, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 feet at a time. But that was 3 or 4 feet that we were fairly confident that we knew what the terrain was like. And later on, we were able to get into more of the rocks. And I was able to use my ice axe to break off little smaller rocks. And basically, we started kicking. And that was a huge come up for us, because having a black rock that was heavier and more likely to roll along that surface that also had better visual contrast on that snow was huge. I mean, you know, that took our confidence radius, so to speak, from maybe 4 feet in either direction to like 10 feet. I mean, we couldn't really see what was happening, but it was more of like, okay, the slope is going this way a little bit. You know, we know that there's not a sudden cliff there at the very least. If it tells us nothing else, we know that we're not approaching onto a cliff within the next 10 feet or so.
I also think that, you know, neither Brennan or I, you know, Brennan could have been really angry with me. You know, I was one who sort of like was like, hey man, we should go climb Mount Hood. And I, you know, had attempted it before and I have been the person to, you know, blame for like not being more prepared. I'm like, you know, was sort of in some ways, leading at first. I mean, we both don't have that much, you know, knowledge obviously, but, so I think we did well is not blaming each other, not yelling, not getting frustrated with each other, really being supportive, being like, how are you doing? How are you holding up? Are you okay? What should we do? We really, you know, kept good communication. For the most part, we stayed calm. And I think that's at the end of the day, what helped us really, you know, get off.
Jacob, Brennan, thank you so much for coming and talking to us. It really, I mean, I admire you for doing this. It's not easy, and you know, it's, but so many people will learn from it and take something from it. So I really appreciate you. Thank you.
And I'll just say, I would totally climb with you guys, being as humble and friendly as you are. You would be really enjoyable to go out with.
I'd be careful in saying that. I will be calling you. I admire the experience, and I you know, would love a climbing partner who knows what the heck they're doing. But no, of course, it's the least we could do to come here and be on this podcast. You know, short of saying this outright, Brent and I do feel like we owe our lives to Portland Mountain Rescue. And so you need some help with the siding on your house, just call us. But genuinely, of course, we're happy, and we hope that someone takes a lesson from this podcast. And yeah, it's the least we could do. We feel really fortunate to have had, you know, this support.
Yeah. And thank you for having us out. And I think it goes without saying, but thank you to Steve and Mark and everybody else in Portland Mountain Rescue for getting us down safely. For me to be able to hear the lecture I got from my mom, that was... Wasn't quite looking forward to that, but it's good to hear it.
I should have told my parents I was climbing Mount Hood before I went, and they were not happy campers on the other end. So I apologize to mom and dad for not telling you, and thank you for telling me I should have been more prepared.
This is all we have for you today. But before we go, I wanted to give a special shout out to the brain behind this podcast and the person who makes sure that I and the podcast sound great. Murray Feher, thank you so much. I really appreciate you. Until next time.